proceed to the next case morning. Marquez versus Norman Mineta. Mr. Brooks.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Lloyd Brooks. I step before you on behalf of plaintiff appellant, my client, Raymond Marquez.
Before you start your argument, I would just like to note one mistake that both parties made in this case. And both parties have mistakenly referred to Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4B4 as the relevant rule for seeking an extension of time to file a notice of appeal. In fact, that rule governs only criminal cases. The relevant rule is Rule 4A5A2, which governs civil matters. Now, the standard under both of the provisions is the same, which is excusable neglect or good cause, but the wrong rule was cited to us by both parties. So just something to put away, not something to be upset about.
Thank you. And with that, I'll pose the question, I guess, to the panel. Would you like me to start with discussing the jurisdictional issue since John has raised that? Essentially, what has occurred is there was excusable neglect on my behalf, and it's kind of strange for me to stand here and talk about this in the first person when it was my actions that lead to the first issue in this case. Essentially, what occurred was there was a miscalculation in the number of days in which the notice of appeal had to be filed in this matter on behalf of my client. However, looking at this court's precedent in case law, I believe that one-day delay in no way means that this court does not have jurisdiction over this matter. In fact, this court's previous case law suggests that the one-day delay is the paramount issue in determining whether or not there's any prejudice to the other party. And case law here in the Seventh Circuit has held that one-day delay is not prejudicial. And because there is no prejudice, it certainly points towards disposing of this matter based on a lack of jurisdiction.
Yeah, but if it's not a one-day delay, if it's two or three, it may not be prejudicial, but that's the rule. So excusable neglect, that's the question of law that we look at. Is this excusable neglect?
And in determining whether or not...
You said a miscalculation.
Yes.
Is that simply, sometimes like what happens when a leap year sneaks in and somebody counts the days and realize, my gosh, there's one more day here I didn't count, and therefore I'm one day over. I've known that to happen. What's the miscalculation here?
Well, the miscalculation, in effect, since I made it, I can speak on that, was essentially miscounting the number of days in one of the months, which pushed over the date in which the brief needed to be filed by a day, but it was incorrectly determined on that day. But in determining whether or not something is excusable neglect, this court has taken into account the inexperience of the counsel who made the mistake. And here, this is my first appeal before this court and my first time needing to calculate the number of days by which notice of appeal had to be filed. And again, pointing toward the fact that there was only one day, there was no bad faith shown by the government in terms of why the one-day delay took place. In effect, the government, in fact, did not oppose the motion in the district court to grant the one-day extension. So certainly there, that needs to be taken into account in whether or not there was any prejudice to the Department of Transportation here. And I do note that in the response brief by the Department of Transportation, they cite to the fact that they believe that they were not given an opportunity to object, and they note some dates upon which the actual motion was granted by the district court. And I would like to point out one error that I noted there as well. Apparently, when my motion was originally being noticed up, it was being noticed up, I believe, for June 24th of last year. But the district court, sua sponte, ruled the day before, so there actually was no hearing on the issue. But on June 24th, I did appear in court, and no one from the Department of Transportation appeared. So it is true that there was no hearing on the matter. However, no one from the Department of Transportation appeared at that hearing in any case. And all I did when I arrived was to find out that the judge had already granted the motion the day before.
There's no dispute in fact. The fact is that you say it's your first appeal, and there's a miscalculation, and you missed it by one day. That's the long and the short of it.
That is, Your Honor, that is. And I only like to point to the fact that this court has held that the key issue is whether or not there is any prejudice. And it is a balancing test. And where there's no prejudice, it weighs on the side of allowing the appeal to go forward. And now I'll move on to the merits of my client's case. The plaintiff appellant here had realized a lifelong dream in becoming an air safety inspector for the Federal Aviation located at O'Hare. And when he was hired, which was in February of 2001, he was employed for approximately 7 months before he was terminated. Feeling that his termination was based on a number of illegal grounds, including race and age, he filed a complaint or lodged a complaint with the EEO. After their investigation, he received his right to sue letter and filed a complaint in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois. And in April of 2004, District Court granted summary judgment in favor of the Department of Transportation. And his case was, the granting of that summary judgment was an error for two reasons. My client posed his case on two theories, one being that he had sufficient direct evidence that there was discrimination on the part of the Department of Transportation, and the second was that he had sufficient evidence to survive the McDonnell-Douglas burden-shifting test. As to direct evidence, my client put forth and is found in the record that there was sufficient evidence that his direct supervisor, Mr. Martinez, had considered illegal grounds in deciding to terminate my client, one of which being that during the EEO investigation, Mr. Martinez actually signed an affidavit that indicated that he did consider race and age when he made employment decisions. This was in response to a question being asked of him of whether or not there were any complaints by my client of any illegal discrimination. So certainly there's evidence that out of Mr. Martinez's own mouth, essentially, that he took into account certain illegal aspects.
Now his, I guess, explanation was that he made an effort to have a lot of diversity, I guess is what he was trying to say, wasn't it?
Well, but I think the point of the matter here is we're on summary judgment, and the fact of the matter is there is other reasonable interpretations of the statement that he made, and the jury was entitled to hear it, especially in light of the other evidence that my client had to determine whether or not it was something innocent that could have been meant by that, or whether or not he meant what it sounds like, which is, and in fact, I believe the quote is, "I try to get a good mix," which is something that is inappropriate. I see now I'm beginning to cross into my rebuttal time. But I would like to address as far as also the indirect burden shifting method as well. There was considerable evidence in the record that suggests that the employer's reasons for termination were simply pretextual. They proffered a number of explanations, such as my client's inability to use a computer, the fact that he had not ascertained a certain amount of completion rate of the number of tasks that he needed to complete his training. And I think underlies a number of those arguments is the fact that his most direct supervisor, Mr. Martinez, instructed his trainer to be harsh on him, in which his trainer responded by saying, "I will not pass him for any tasks that he is working on," which affected other trainers who also gave my client an opportunity to learn as well, because they all instructed that what would happen is that when he was being graded on any particular task, they would not finalize an approval grade without the approval of his most direct primary trainer, who was being told and approved of not giving my client any kind of a passing grade on any task. I'd like to reserve any remaining time for rebuttal.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Donatelli.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, counsel. First, I want to thank Judge Rovner for the tip. I've been in the civil division for, 12 years now? 15 years, I think, and I should know my civil role, but you're never too old to learn, are you, Judge?
I have never stopped opening that book to check.
Counsel had addressed the jurisdictional issue. He said the government believes it did not have notice, and, of course, that would be attributable to me. I'm the one who believes I did not have notice since I was assigned to this case. As I provided in my supplemental response, the motion for extension of time was filed June 14th. No certificate of service was attached to the copy I received eventually, nor to the one I could find in the court's docket. I attached the backside of my motion, which has the U.S. Attorney's Office stamp on it, and I received it June 28th, long after it was granted. And I just raise this because I don't think it's a fair argument to say, well, the government wasn't there to object. I didn't know about it. Whether I would have objected or not is a whole other thing. I suppose I could go back in retrospect. But
would it have mattered if you had objected or not? Would it ever matter under this court's case law in Krizovets versus Indiana Bell?
Right. And that's the thing with jurisdiction, especially from a lawyer's point of view. This court knows what its power is and what it isn't, and I can't agree to it or argue it one way or the other. So I agree. I think it comes down to he was a day late. Counsel was a day late. Now, as a lawyer, I feel for him. We all know that's our worst nightmare, being late, and there but for the grace of God go I. But I also know that jurisdiction is a lot bigger than feelings. And under the case you cited, Judge, under the law, I didn't hear anything that shows excusable neglect. And, of course, Judge Lindbergh didn't analyze it that way either. So you have both those problems going. So I would suggest there's no jurisdiction. As for the rest of the argument, counsel talked about the statement from the supervisor showing his intent to discriminate, because he said in his EEO statement, quote, I have hired people of all races, national origin, and ages, and try to get a good mix. And that's the statement that shows that he deliberately fired Mr. Marquez because he was Hispanic and because of his age. And if people can't say, I try and get a good mix anymore, that's the goal of even government hiring. You want the good mix, but, of course, you have to hire individually, and I think that's the obvious interpretation of that statement. That just is not discrimination. Counsel's other argument was that his first trainer was instructed to be hard on him. I will point out that the only evidence of that is plaintiff's own affidavit. The inspector, Riggs, doesn't say that in his affidavit, and instead what he says is, I tried for 2 months to work with this guy, and I was losing sleep at night. I finally had to say, get somebody else. This isn't working with me, because he couldn't follow anything. And then after that, they actually got the guy, the go-to guy who trained everybody. He worked with them for the next 4 months, and his conclusion was, this guy should have never been hired. And all my years here, he's been the weakest I've ever seen. You know, it comes down to, in these cases so often, in these discrimination cases, that plaintiffs seem to make such allegations because they don't face up to their own truths. And I think Mr. Marquez falls in that category of plaintiff who just was not suited to this job. And this is an important job, the safety of aircraft and inspection. He was not suited to that job, and rather than face up to that reality, he's making these charges. Because even besides these inspectors, all of the inspectors said, this guy's out of his element. He was in his probationary period, and this is just too important a job to have someone who's below par. So I think when you look at the record in this case, you're going to see the district court got this one exactly right, and you should reach the same conclusion. So we ask this court to affirm.
Okay, thank you. Do you have anything to add, Mr. Brooks?
Yes, I think just a couple quick points.
How much time? You got 1 minute.
Thank you.
I'd like to first start with my client not being cut out. The record clearly states that my client was more than qualified for this position. He'd been an aircraft mechanic for some of the largest airlines in the world for 36 years before taking this position. There is no way that he did not understand the job in which he was entailing. And in fact, at the time he was terminated for being such a woefully inadequate employee, he in fact had a completion rate of his tasks that were higher than the number of employees who were kept after him. So the Department of Transportation's reasons for firing him just don't measure up. Something else was going on there, and we proffered that something else was some form of illegal discrimination. There were a number of employees who were allowed up to 32 months to complete the training program for which my client was given just over 6. The record certainly shows that there was sufficient test of the reasons given by the employer. I see my time is up.
Okay, thank you. This case will be taken under advisement. We'll move to the last case.